We're going to get started just because we have another session starting right at 4:00, and I want as much of Mr. John Noetler as we can get today. This is session 2, A Piece of My Mind, a book that he wrote and photographed. Was it 2010, and a new one's coming out this fall.
Next month.
And part of your gift is sparking this conversation, so we're really looking forward to it. Just so you know that the session is recorded, so anything that you say or however you participate will also be on the recording. Welcome and thank you for coming, and thank you, John, for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
And Cannon will be used against you.
Is anyone going to fall asleep if I turn off?
Never.
So, hello again. Who has seen one of these around Holden? One of the peace signs? Good. Who has added one at Holden?
Literally or figuratively?
Oh, good question. Literally, who has built a little peace sign?
Who has stepped on one?
Oh yeah, that's me. There's still time. I don't necessarily advise this method that my son used when we went to the Cadillac Ranch, but I guess that was part of the process. So, do I understand this right, that the work is done?
Woo!
Yeah?
Yes.
That's the good news. The bad news is that for many of us that means that our time is short.
True.
And so, to start today, I want you to think for just a few minutes about how you're going to use the time that remains here, what you're going to do with that. A lot of the images that I've been sharing with you are just straight portraits, and I wanted to share for these first few minutes some pretty pictures, some eye candy. And so we'll start that with a little bit of music, and then get on with the talk. I want to put a little image in your mind about how this project came about, because I think sometimes we feel like we have to have things all figured out before we start on a big journey. You know, if we want to sort of engage in a big years-long project like this, it can be hard to take that first step if you don't feel like you know exactly where you're going to go. But I like to describe this entire process as walking along a foggy path, right? Where you can see about 2 steps in front of you and you can't see any further than that. But when you take those 2 steps, what happens? You can see a little bit more, right? And so I decided really early on with this project that as long as I could see a couple of steps, I was going to keep on moving. So, you know, I think most of you were here for the first session. But in a nutshell, in case you weren't, I started photographing and interviewing people, asking them, what does peace mean to you? I did the first 50 stories in Minnesota, where I'm from. Created a book, created a traveling exhibit from that. And then I thought I was all done. And I thought that for about 2 weeks, and then I realized there was more work to do. So we set out across the country. I did this in a number of trips. I couldn't really afford to take a whole year off and travel, so I did it in little bits and pieces in between assignment work when I could fit it in. And altogether, I don't know, I think it was 9 or 10 trips, traveled 40,000 miles, interviewed 100 people in 46 states, and really A Piece of My Mind became a project about listening, right? About hearing other people's stories. And for this second book, I really was intentional about reaching out to people who personified some of the issues of the day, you know, some of the social challenges that our country is facing. And so so I met people like Tyrone Wirtz, and I want to share a handful of these stories with you, maybe give you a little bit of background on how I came across these people, some of the things that I learned. The logistics of planning a project like this were kind of daunting, and so when I was going to a particular place, in this case I was going to go to Philadelphia, and I knew I wanted to talk to somebody about this notion of restorative justice. Restorative justice is this idea that justice doesn't only have to be punitive, but justice can be about healing for both the perpetrator and the victim. And so I reached out to a professor I knew. His name is, his name is Howard Zare. And he's a professor at Eastern Mennonite University. He's known as the grandfather of the restorative justice movement. And I said, hey, Howard, I'm going to Philadelphia. Who should I talk to? And he said, oh, you got to connect with a guy named Tyrone Wirtz. Tyrone had served 36 years of a life sentence for second-degree murder. His sentence eventually was commuted, and he was released, and now he works with at-risk youth in Philadelphia to try to make sure that they don't make the same sort of decisions Tyrone made. And Tyrone said that there were certain acts of compassion that were shown to him when he was in prison, that there were one or two people in the system that recognized some inherent value in him and took an interest in him. And he said it was when that happened that Tyrone was able to go from being the angry young man he had been and turn into the person that his mother and father had raised him to be. You know, so when I hear that, I wonder who it is in my life whose world I can change just by giving that attention and that hope. When I interviewed Tyrone, we did the interview in his dumpy little office at Temple University. Just plain white walls, there was not much to it. And I said to him at the end, I said, Tyrone, I don't think there's going to be any interesting photograph we can make here. We've got to think of something else. And so we talked for a little while, and finally I looked at him and I said, well, how about this? I said, here you are, you know, looking like your reformed self, wearing a suit and tie, you look sharp. It seems to me it would be an interesting visual contrast to photograph your reformed self out in front of the house where the murder happened. And he didn't say very much, and I thought, oh, that's probably not what you're supposed to ask a guy that just got out of prison. But eventually he said, you know what, that would mean a lot to me, to go back to that place. He hadn't been back there since. And so this is the home where the murder had happened. And it convinced me in my own mind that you really can ask people anything. Right? Sometimes I think we back away from these conversations because we're afraid that we're not supposed to ask that, or we're going to offend somebody. But I think if you ask with a genuine interest in learning, that people sense that. You know, if you're asking someone to challenge them, that's one thing. But if you're asking them because you're genuinely interested, for the most part, I think people are open to that. I met people like Talat Hamdani. She's a Pakistani immigrant. She was living in Brooklyn. Her son was in his early 20s, and he was an EMT. He was a New York Police Department cadet. He was on his way to school. He was still going to school. He was on his way to school on the train in the morning on 9/11, when 9/11 happened, and he didn't come home. Right? He didn't come home the first day. He didn't come home the second day. He didn't come home, and she didn't know where he was. His phone wasn't working. He'd left it at home that day, actually. So she did what everybody did. She went, she scoured the hospitals, and she was looking at all of the papers that were put up. They never found him, but the news started coming out, and because, of course, he's Muslim, and nobody could find Salman, they assumed maybe he was part of the plot. So Talat was dealing with the loss of her son, and also, you know, the degradation of his character. Eventually, they found his body as they were cleaning up the towers. He was faced going upstairs in the tower stairwell. He had his EMT bag with him, and the best she can figure out is when he saw that happen, he went down to see what he could do to help. Out of all of the memorials that are listed, Salman's name is not listed on any of the New York Police Department memorials for the people who were lost that day. She's been fighting for that since 9/11 happened, since they figured it out. The police departments will claim that it's because he was only a cadet, he wasn't you know, a member of the full-fledged police department. She wonders if maybe it has something to do with his Muslim faith. When I do these interviews, I don't, you know, I do check some facts and make sure they're accurate, but I don't make judgments. I let people tell their stories. I am there just to listen. Michael Reed talks about being in a rock band with a lead singer who was addicted to heroin, and eventually he went that same path. He spent 10 years addicted to heroin, and as he says, you know, eventually he missed his, well, he was making a lot of other bad choices to support that. He said eventually he missed his, wait, there's parole, and what's the other P? Probation. Probation is when you haven't been in prison, I think. Right? So he had these probation meetings, but he kept missing them. Because he says when you're a junkie, he said there's really only one appointment that you're interested in, and it's with your next fix. So eventually he went to jail because of his heroin addiction. He cleaned up his act, and when he came out, he was working at a halfway house. He was helping some people who had some mental disabilities, and they needed to go to a food shelf. So he kind of reluctantly went with them. And when he was there, one of the volunteers had trouble lifting a big bag, and Michael's a big guy, and they said, can you help me with this? And he reluctantly did, and he, they told him he should come back and volunteer again. So he did, he kept going back. Now, Michael's been clean for about 15 years, and he actually runs the food distribution program for only over 500 families. Mm-hmm. So he's changed his whole perspective. This is Deanna Thompson, and actually, Deanna has helped me decide maybe what my next book is going to be, which I think is going to be called A Piece of My Mind, Final Wisdom. And I intend to interview people who are at the end of their life, who are facing their own mortality. Deanna Thompson talks about, well, I think it was about 7 years ago now, she was diagnosed with a form of cancer that should have killed her in 5 years. Like a 97% mortality rate within 5 years. But I interviewed her at the 6-year mark. And she was healthy and she was doing well and she was still enjoying time with her kids. And we had this really interesting conversation about how you go on living when you know that you're dying. And she said, you know, all of us are dying, right? In one form or another. She said, I just happen to be doing it in a more acute fashion than most. And she talks, really articulately about the same thing I was saying with Tyrone, that people are afraid to say the wrong thing, right? You don't want to say the wrong thing to somebody with cancer because you don't want to offend them, you don't want to stir up bad feelings. And she admits that people do say dumb things sometimes, right? Because they're uncomfortable, because they don't know what to say. But she said, go ahead and say it. She said it's important to make those connections. And she said that for her, when people say stupid things, on her good days, she's able to sort of come back with some grace, and she's able to come back with some forgiveness, and maybe even a little education in the process. She also admits that when she's faced with her own mortality, when she's dealing with cancer, not all days are good days. So she hopes for a little bit of grace back and forth with people. This is Jarrell Wilson. Jarrell is one of the reasons why I don't have a publisher. Because I had a book offer, I had a contract offer from a publishing company, and it's a faith-based company, and that's good because I'm a faith-based person and this is part of my motivation for doing this project. However, this publishing company is more conservative than I am, and they decided that they couldn't include any gay or lesbian voices in the project. I didn't understand how I could possibly produce a project which is built around the concept of listening to others, whether you agree with them or not, and then be asked to censor certain voices because they didn't meet the theology. I also don't understand, if we're talking theology, how it's okay to include a straight Muslim person in the book, but it's not okay to include a gay Christian person in the book. That didn't make any sense. So it was a great contract. It was the first and only book contract I've ever been offered, and I needed to walk away from it because it wasn't fair to people like Jarrell. And Jarrell starts out his interview, and this is why I couldn't let it go. And he says, I'm black, gay, Christian, and I live in Texas. He said, so you would think I'd be miserable, but I see beauty everywhere. And he goes on to talk about what I led the other talk with, which is Jesus says he's saying goodbye to his disciples, and he says, I leave you with peace. I give you my peace. And he said maybe that's what we ought to be doing more for one another. Instead of getting all bound up in the things we have problems with, be giving one another our peace. This is Kenny. And I don't have a lot to say about Kenny's interview right now because I can't remember what part of it I'm putting in the book. I have to go back and review the notes. But Kenny is a Cajun shrimp fisherman. And I'll be honest with you, when it came time to go down to Louisiana, as I was picking out who I was going to interview, I remembered seeing the movie Forrest Gump. You see the movie? Mm-hmm. Bubba Gump Shrimp? I remember the scene of the shrimp boats going out and their big wings and their nets, and I thought, well, that's kind of cool. And I'm a photographer, I'm a visual person, so I thought, well, how am I going to get myself on a shrimp boat? So I called a lawyer down there who I found in the newspaper who had done class action lawsuits with BP on behalf of the shrimp fishermen whose livelihoods had been affected, and I explained what I was trying to do, and he said, oh, I got a whole list of shrimp fishermen who'd be happy to talk with you. So they connected me with Kenny in Chauvin, Louisiana. We got done with the interview, and he looked at me and he said, well, where are you staying tonight? And this is a well-rehearsed line that I have, and I said, well, I have no idea where I'm staying. What do you suggest? And Kenny said, well, I got a burnt-out RV in the backyard if you want to sleep in that. I'm cheap. I said, yeah, sure. And he said, well, then if you want in the morning, we'll go out looking for alligators. And I thought, well, why not? So we did that. And only problem was with the RV, the toilet didn't work. And it occurred to me as I was stepping outside in the middle of the night to go find a bush that there were alligators. So that was a quick process. But we got done looking for alligators, and he said, well, what are you doing tonight? And I didn't have to be into Alabama till the next day. And I said, well, I've got some free time. And he said, well, I'm going out shrimping. Would you like to come along? And so I went out on the Gulf of Mexico. You can see this is not OSHA approved, I don't think. That's safety gear. And we went out, and you go out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you come back at 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we caught 1,200 pounds of shrimp that night. I don't think I've eaten shrimp since. I never ate shrimp before anyway. So one of my jobs was to throw, I played a game called shrimp, not shrimp. This is not shrimp. When they haul in the nets, they basically dump everything on the deck of the boat, and then they shovel it all into a little tank and start sorting. And I ran around being the tree hugger that I am and took everything that was not a shrimp and started pitching it back in the water. Kenny thought I was a little ridiculous, but I kept doing it anyway. So these are some of the extra sort of things that I've been able to come across. Julissa Arce was an undocumented immigrant. Her parents had a small jewelry business selling at art fairs and things like that, and they would cross back and forth across the border. They would buy product from manufacturers in Mexico. They had all the permits they would come across and they would sell. Well, one time they got robbed of all their inventory. You know, they used to do this about 10 times a year, and it was enough to make a living. One time they got robbed of all their inventory in a hotel parking lot, and they were way behind on their debts to the manufacturers. So then they had to start doing it more regularly. Julissa stayed in Mexico with her grandparents, and while her parents were selling jewelry, and she figured out apparently pretty quickly that the more she misbehaved, more frequently her parents would come back to check on her. So things weren't going well with her grandparents, and finally her parents just brought her up to the States, and she was on a three-year visa along with their work permit, but when she turned 14 it expired, and she just stayed. You know, she was with her parents, and they had permits to stay. She did not. She just stayed. She realized when it was time to go to college that she could either, pack up and go back to Mexico, where she no longer really had any connections, or she could fake her way in. She bought some false papers. She was a great student, got really great grades. She eventually, with her false papers, got an internship for Goldman Sachs. She did very well at Goldman Sachs. She got offered a position, still with her fake papers. She eventually worked herself into a vice president's position of derivative trading at Goldman Sachs. Nobody ever knew her status. She said, if I would have had an accent, if I was working in a restaurant, if I was working in a hotel as a maid, they would have asked more questions. They wouldn't have believed me. She said, but because I am who I am, they trusted me, she said, and I kept on going. Now she's quit this position, and now she works as an immigration rights activist. She said, people always tell her, well, you should have just gotten in line. You should have done it the right way. She said, there's not really a line. She said, if there had been a line, I would have gotten in it long ago. She's a citizen now. I also have an undocumented immigrant who's currently undocumented, who I interviewed, and he encouraged me to use his full name in the book. I've chosen to use just his first name. He feels like it's really important, Cesar feels like it's really important to have the story told, to come out of the shadows, so that other people understand. You know, these are, the fact that we don't have an effective process is leaving a lot of people in limbo. This is John George, who lived in Detroit, in a deteriorating neighborhood like so many of them in Detroit. He lived next to a crack house. He had one kid already, he had another on the way, and he decided that he could either move away or he could do something about it. So he went down to the hardware store, he bought lumber, hammer and nails, and he boarded up the crack house so that the drug dealers couldn't get in there, and mowed the lawn, fixed the place up, and found that they scurried away somewhere else. His motto is that we're out to change the world, and we're starting with Detroit. And he started an organization called Motor City Blight Busters. And in Detroit, they have about 10,000 volunteers that come out every year, and they've now torn down about 1,500 houses over the last decade, and they turn those into community gardens and other neighborhood assets, trying to return a little bit of ownership to the neighborhoods, trying to flip it so that the blight goes away and they can reclaim their communities. This is Myron Fourier, who is the great-grandson of Black Elk. Black Elk had a vision. There's a book called Black Elk Speaks. Black Elk went to the top of the highest point in South Dakota when he was young, and he had a vision about all people living as one together. And then they named the surrounding wilderness around that highest peak after Black Elk. But then they also named the very point of the highest peak after Harney, who has a really problematic history with having been a part of certain Indian massacres over the years. So Myron is leading a campaign to change the name of Harney Peak to Black Elk Peak, and they're making some progress. He's actually got the grandson, great-grandson of Harney as well, who's on his side. So they're working with the U.S. Department of Names to get that changed. How many more have I got? I think this is the last one that I'll share. And again, this is kind of how this project comes together. It's an organic process. When I was going down south a couple summers ago, which, by the way, July and August are not the right times to go to Mississippi and Alabama, I had an interview lined up in Alabama. I usually have about 70% of my interviews lined up before I hit the road because I want to make sure that I'm productive. But I also leave about 30% of them open in case something interesting comes up that I can take advantage of. I had lined something up for Alabama the day before. The guy called and said, oh, I can't make it to the interview, so I was stuck with nothing. So I pitched out the question to Facebook. I said, does anybody know anybody that I could interview in Alabama? And two different people from different parts of my life said, oh, you should reach out and contact Joanne Bland. So I Googled her, I found her phone number, and called her up, and I explained the project. I said, is there any chance you have 5 hours free tomorrow? And she said, tell me more. And actually, I gave her the link to my website, and I said, look at that, I'll call you back in an hour, and we'll see what you think. And she called me back, and she said, yeah, come on over. Joanne Bland marched from Selma to Montgomery with Martin Luther King Jr. when she was 11 years old. I interviewed her in her living room 12 days after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. So it was this really really raw conversation of her saying, boy, I thought we did this when I was a kid, right? Why are we still seeing some of these same things? And Joanne says, you know, I believe we'll get there someday. I believe that we'll find that beloved community. We'll find a way to get together. She said, but I'm tired of waiting. She said, I want it to be in my lifetime. I want it to be now. You might know these. I know you know this person. Does anybody know Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. He's not here anymore, is he?
No.
No, okay. All right, so when I passed through this year, last year, I interviewed these two folks, and they'll both be in the new book as well. So one of the things that has occurred to me as I'm doing all of these stories is this notion of identity, right? This notion of understanding who we are and how that affects our life. When I was talking with Plow, the publisher who wanted me to remove all of the gay and lesbian voices from the project, they said, well, why do we have to talk about sexuality at all? We don't have people that are saying, oh yeah, I'm straight here, I'm straight that. And I said, it's really not up to me. I said, if this is what's important to these people about who they are, if this is a part of how they view themselves, then that's up to them to sort of share that identity. And I want to do this exercise that you have in front. How did that happen? Lights, good. Oh, there, yeah. I'm slow. There is Holden magic going on. So I don't want to spend a lot of time with you filling this out, but I mean, when we say the words I am from, very often we think geography, right? I'm from Minnesota, I'm from Bloomington. But there are some prompts there that are going to help you explore it a little more deeply. You know, what sort of socioeconomic class did you come from? What sort of support network did you come from? What are the values that you come from? And so I want you to spend, I don't know, 3-4 minutes just running through there and filling that out. And, you know, dig deeply. So now I want you to quickly go back through that list. I want you to look at what you've written for identities. And on the ones that you view as positive things in your life, just put a little plus. The ones that might be difficult in some way or a struggle, just put a little minus. Spend some time going through the list there. I'll grab you one, Dale. Is this an extra one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We were just talking about identity and ways we see ourselves and ways we define ourselves. And don't take much time on this, just sort of quickly go through. Holy moly, what a mess. What are some of the things you have listed? What are some of the things that came to mind as you think about where you're from?
As pluses or?
Either one. Anybody have something they want to share?
Have a strong role model in my grandmother.
Strong role model in your grandma.
Okay.
So if it were me, I would say things like, you know, if I sort of compiled a bunch of them, you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy from suburbia. I came from parents. From an intact family, parents who were supportive but pretty conservative and traditional. I come from a place of practicality that embraces the notion of dreaming and whimsy. What else? Are there any other positive things that people have on their list for identity?
Well, my various interests in the fact that I live in a situation where I have the opportunity to pursue and embrace those interests, okay. Unlike a fleeing refugee or somebody who lives in, you know, a situation where that just isn't possible.
Yeah, good. Anybody else? Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of fell into a career that
people generally identify with. It's one of those that people, that's what you are.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed me a great lifestyle and a lot of fun at work. So that was a big plus of, you know, where I'm from.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just retired from that, so that's a little grieving process. So.
Oh, right, because an identity shifts,
it's
right?
Gone, yeah.
When that's such a big part of who you are and that's not there anymore.
It's not there. I used to be that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm a baby boomer, and I realize these days that even coming from a family that didn't have, you know, we had enough,
mm-hmm.
But worried about, you know, whether we were going to always have enough. But given the time I grew up in, it was an economy and everything, a time that allowed somebody who worked hard in school and everything could get to college, could do things and it'd be okay. You, at least, you know, unless you had a bunch of strikes against you. But
right.
For most folks, you could work things out. Now it seems like it's much harder than it is.
Yeah. Yeah. What about any negative things? If you don't want to share it, that's okay. But is there anything on your list that you find challenging? Yeah.
I thought the political affiliation question was interesting because I realized I don't know what political affiliation my parents really are because it's something you don't talk about.
Oh, right, right.
It's very like Texas Germany. You don't talk about money and you don't talk about politics.
Right, right.
So that was interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, anybody else have any negatives? Yeah.
Well, I think that in thinking about the gender question, it's like I love being a woman, but there's times when it's hard being a woman in society, and so there's kind of that tension between positive and negative.
Right. Right, and to hold that in balance is a challenge. I grew up, I was the kid who wasn't very good. I struck out at T-ball, actually, when I was a kid. Is that even possible? Yeah?
Oh,
good. Thank you. It's nice to have company. I was in the arts. I had really good posture when I was in middle school and high school. So I was a gay kid, right? Everybody was pretty sure I was a gay kid, which is neither here nor there, except I wasn't. And so I felt misunderstood because of that. And I think more than anything, when I hear people talking in a piece of my mind about struggles, it's all revolving around being misunderstood, mm-hmm. miscategorized. People don't understand your potential because you're one of them, whatever that category is. What's that?
I had that on my list too, one of my negatives, feeling.
Like you were misunderstood. Yeah, yeah, and so think of the power of reaching across to somebody who feels misunderstood and just being able to say, I hear you, I see you. That's a powerful thing. Where was I going to go with that? I was in a fifth grade class in Minneapolis and we did this exercise and there was one kid that didn't have a single positive identity on his list. I mean, when I went through and made my list, it was pretty positive. I got a lot of stuff that gave me a good foundation. He didn't have a single positive thing on his list. So imagine what that's like as you're growing up. There's an exercise I do before, just in my head, before I go into every interview. And I'll ask you to do it with me. I want you to make the little okay sign. All right? There's a little circle there. And I want you to imagine in the middle of that circle is all of the knowledge and experience that you've had in your life. Right? That's about right. Yep. This is representative and symbolic. It's not factual. Imagining that's your experience. That's everything that you've ever done in your life, everything you've ever known, all the knowledge you've compiled. Now, with your fingers or your hands or your arms, somehow indicate the size of the circle that would represent all of the knowledge that has ever existed in the universe. How big is that going to be? Yeah, don't hit the person next to you, right? I try to keep that image in mind when I go into an interview, right? there's every chance that this person I'm talking to has a bit of knowledge that falls outside of my circle, that lives somewhere else in this enormous circle, right? And so my job, when I encounter them, is to try to expand my circle a little bit. Mm. Not drag them into mine, but expand my own so that I can learn a little bit more about the world. I can learn a little bit more about their identity and their experience, and hopefully bridge that gap of misunderstanding. Do me a favor and flip over that piece of paper. It should be blank on the back if the world is working the right way. And I want you to thinking about all of these things, thinking about justice, fairness, equity, building bridges, I want you to just finish this statement. I wish. Be bold, you know, stretch, reach for a high level, and just finish that. Finish that up in a second, and when you're done answering that question, finish this one. I will. Because no matter how lofty that goal is you set with your first statement, there's something you can do with the second statement to move in that direction. Anybody care to share their I wish?
I will.
Yeah.
I wish I could be a grateful enough person that it would influence everyone around me to be grateful also. Mm. I will be grateful whenever it is now.
I think it's several people in the project have talked about gratitude, and I think what's the old computer saying, garbage in, garbage out. We surround ourselves with these negative voices and these difficult voices, and that can't help but take a toll on you eventually. And I think that exercise in gratitude and in patience and in grace, I think given the world we live in, it becomes ever more important to exercise those things. Somebody recently referred to a piece of my mind as a great cloud of witnesses, which I think is a biblical reference. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways this project often is about preaching to the choir. I think it also can reach outside of that when the exhibit's installed, when some of these conversations happen. But at first, the thought of preaching to the choir bothered me, but I think the choir needs encouragement too, right? Because when you are trying to make a positive impact in the world, that can be a lonely place. That can be a difficult place to be. And the problem seems so big and our impact seems so small, but to surround yourself with these stories of 50 people who are trying to make a positive impact in the world, that's encouraging. You know, that helps me believe that it's actually possible. And so I think those exercises and what we feed ourselves and how we spend our time becomes incredibly important. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
said, I wish people would not promote their own agenda but seek common ground.
I wish people would not seek their own agenda but promote common ground.
Right.
Is there an I will that goes along with that?
I will be more open to engaging in opportunities that are presented.
Yeah. Or even creating opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, good. One more?
Yeah.
I wish people could learn to talk and listen with respect, and that I could do it better.
Hmm. Yeah, me too, for me. Is there an I will?
I will get better at speaking with the ones who make me uncomfortable or are different from me.
Yeah. Yeah, there have been any number of times in this project where I needed to go outside of my comfort zone, right? Where I had the chance to interview somebody who was recently released from prison, where I had the chance to sit down with an undocumented immigrant. You know, these are, there have been a couple of places I've gone into where I text Karen before I go in. I'm like, okay, here's the address I'm at. If you don't hear from me in a couple hours, at least you know where to start. But I've only met good people. But it's an exercise. It's a discipline to go outside of your comfort zone and to be willing to hear that fully. We didn't have much time for questions on Tuesday, and I'd like to leave a little time now before we have to make room for Chris. Is it Chris or is it you, Mark?
Chris.
Chris is
my name.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's Chris. Is
oh, okay.
Creeks.
Oh, that's right.
No.
Are you here?
It's going to be in here.
All right.
We had to change it to Fireside because we'd switch.
There's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Do you guys have any questions about this project or about, I don't know, anything?
Can you articulate how you've changed? Who were you if I met John before we started this project compared to now?
Interesting. I'm more patient. I'm more willing to say I don't know. Because I think I was more of an activist bent earlier on. And I was pretty black and white about things. You know, rapidly liberal, and really had very little patience with other viewpoints. I would decide pretty quickly when I met somebody if they got it or not. You know? And I'm a little slower to come to that conclusion. I'm a little quicker to say, well, what's the rest of the story? And I'm also, although I always was this way, I'm increasingly this way, skeptical of whatever I see on the news. Because when I watch the news broadcasts of Occupy Wall Street, and they were called, you know, slackers and lazy and dirtbags and rabble-rousers, and then I went down to hang out with some of them, they were nothing of the sort. You know, when I hear how the media refers to the people in Black Lives Matter, it paints one picture, and when I go down and hang out with them, it's an entirely different picture. Right? So I am highly skeptical of what I see in mainstream media, and was always the case, but now even more so.
Thanks.
Does that answer?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting.
What else? I'm a trained interviewer. I will sit in silence for a long time. That's one of the greatest techniques in interviewing, right? Just shut up and listen, right? And people will squirm when there's silence, and that's when they say some of the greatest stuff. Because they gotta fill that space, and when they do, it's some of the best stuff.
Part of the reason I asked you that question is because a friend of mine, when I was talking to him about our work, said, my favorite projects and the projects that mean the most to me are the ones that change me for the better.
Mm.
And so then I've started thinking about that as I decide what I should take on and what I shouldn't take on.
Yeah, that's a great one.
What's going to change me? And I found myself thinking, I wonder how this has changed John. I bet it has. So
yeah.
Thanks for answering. Yeah, of course. Thank you. You had your hand up?
Yeah. What got you started on this whole thing?
I mean, my dad was a social worker and my mom was an educator. So these sorts of social justice things always, if not overtly, they sort of were always present, you know, thinking about the greater good and the well-being of others. And then as a freelance photographer, I constantly had a personal project going at any given time. And usually it was, you know, I would support this nonprofit. I'd go travel for a week with them and photograph and they could use the photos. Or I would support this group with a week-long project or something. I really was hungering for my own project. Like assignment work, someone calls you and says, you should go take a picture of this. And you say, okay. And you go and you take pretty pictures and then you hand it off and that project's done. Well, I wanted something I could sort of claim for my own. I was photographing and documenting people that were doing really interesting things. And I thought, I'd like to do something interesting myself. And so all this was spinning around in my mind, and really I was super frustrated with the quality of our national dialogue, how polarized the debate was. And then when the economy tanked and I had some free time, I decided to fill it up with this. Really? Mm-hmm. So cool. Yeah.
How many questions can do you formulate before you get there? Do you have a few?
So I'm trained as a journalist. So listening and plumbing people for information is kind of what I've always done. There are like five questions. I mean, basically we start out and I say, tell me about yourself. If I didn't know anything about you, what would you want me to know? What's your identity? And then I say, you know, what does peace mean to you? How do you work towards it in your life? What are some of the obstacles you encounter along the way? This one I love. Tell me about a time when you saw a great example of peace. Right? Because when we start talking about peace, we start talking about rainbows and ponies and stuff that's up here. When you say, tell me a time when you saw an example of that, not reading about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but what did you see in your life? That brings it to the ground. Right, that makes it real. Other than that, my favorite questions are, what do you mean by that? And tell me more. You know, because people will give you little snippets, and you have to dig sometimes for the gold.
Do you record your interviews then?
So I do, yeah. Back? Yeah, I record them. And I tell them this even from the first time we talk. I say, so we're going to record the interview, then I'm going to ask you to sign a release that says I can do anything I want with this, and you never get to review it before it's published. And for some reason, they do. I don't know. But I take that responsibility very seriously, and I'm neurotic about trying to make sure. I mean, you can edit a story to say anything you want it to, right? But I take really seriously this obligation to present that person's story with authenticity the way they intended for it to be represented, especially when I'm dealing with someone who comes from a demographic whose voice may not be as loud as it should be in the world. And so that's my job. So what I do is after I release the podcast, I send them a link to it and I say, let me know how I did. And if there's something glaring, I would probably fix it, but I kind of wear it as a badge of honor that 100% of the time they say one of two things. Yep, that's just what I was trying to say. Or, wow, you made me sound smarter than I thought I was that day. So that means a lot to me, you know, that that they agree with the way I've edited their story. What'd you say?
I need you to interview me then.
Oh, okay, yeah. We'll come up with your mission. Yeah. You know, I think we should move over to Chris's. No, right here.
Yeah.
Right here?
Okay.
All right. Well, sounds good. Thank you again.